Welcome back to the Dealmakers Podcast Show with serial entrepreneur Alejandro Cremades, best-selling author of The Art of Startup Fundraising and co-founder at Panthera Advisors. In this podcast, we ask our guests about their successful acquisitions and financing rounds.
Alrighty, hello everyone and welcome to the Dealmaker Show. So today we have a founder, a really incredible founder, repeated founder, a founder that has done it many times, very successfully so, with great exits. You know, he's done it on the bootstrapping way, on the not bootstrapping way, raising money from people, just like right now he's doing something amazing, you know, in the world of AI, you know, which, you know, everyone, I mean, he's been involved with this whole space for a long time, before he was even called AI. So we're going to be talking about all the good stuff, building, scaling, financing, exiting, and brace yourself for a very inspiring episode. So without further ado, let's welcome our guest today, Molham Arif. Welcome to the show.
Thank you, Alejandro. It's a pleasure to be here. Thanks for having me.
So originally born in Beirut, in Lebanon, but you moved quite a bit there, you know, with your family around Switzerland, Egypt, all over the place. How was life growing up for you?
Yeah, I mean, this is what was normal for me. My dad worked for a multinational company called DuPont, and every few years we just have to pick up and move. And I think there's something very valuable about the experience of like being the new person in an environment where you're not quite sure about the culture, about the language. You know, this the environment sort of changes, and you learn to listen and observe and to absorb and adapt. And really, you learn about sort of the sort of common threads in humanity, right? No one has a monopoly on good. No one has a monopoly on bad. And every culture, every society has its own strengths and appealing aspects of it.
Well, you mentioned something very, very profound there, learning to adapt. And I find that for you, having had the chance of moving from one place to another, making friends again, you know, especially at a young age, I'm sure that that shaped you a lot. I'm sure that that has served you very well in your entrepreneurial journey. So I guess, how do you think, you know, like that really made who you are today?
I think it's essential. I still keep up with friends I made on the journey here. And even, you know, that the transition to college and the transition to graduate school and getting into startups. And after sort of the exit from my most recent startup before this one, At the time, I had a daughter who was, I don't know, 8 or 9 years old. And I wanted the same experience for her. So we moved from Atlanta to New York so she could have the experience of moving and adapting. And we stayed in New York City for a couple of years and then moved to the Bay Area. And it's not as international as the experience that I had, but it's still, you know, I think it's great for her. And I want it for her. I want it for everybody. I think we all do better when we're exposed to more things. So
out of all things, how did you start getting involved with the whole world of, let's say, AI? Back then it was called computational technology.
Yeah, computational intelligence was the term we used in the early 90s because we were in the middle of an AI winter, and AI was seen as like a really bad thing. We called it either computational intelligence or data mining or database mining. There was also a reemergence of neural networks, so that was allowed to say neural networks. But the last thing you could call it was AI. And so, yeah, just basically, in business, whether you know you're running a small business or a large business, but in particular, if you're running a large business, you're deploying hundreds of millions, billions of capital to inventory, to capital, to wireless spectrum, to manufacturing capacity, to transportation, to labor. Like all of these decisions can be make or break decisions, and you want to make them with the benefit of the best analysis. And over the years, you know, humanity has invented, you know, techniques for doing that, predictive technologies that help you understand what your customers or what the market might want, or prescriptive technology to help you manage logistics. You know, this is the stuff that was invented around World War II to help deploy armies and logistics of armies because, you know, armies win and lose because they have ammunition and food and, you know, manpower. And so all of these things are technologies that have been developed over the years that we deploy that really can make the difference between an organization or a business being successful or not. So that's how I got into it. I got into it also sort of just out of curiosity and interest about how to teach computers to make decisions like we do. You know, how can we recognize things in images, or how can we understand text, or, you know, all of that is deeply, deeply interesting scientifically.
And talking about interesting, quite interesting too, is the shift from AT&T, you know, after your studies at Georgia Tech, to doing IPOs. I mean, it's quite a different experience there.
Yeah, I really chased my interest. So, you know, when I started, my first job was with AT&T. I took a summer internship with them to work on computer vision in an advanced development group out of Atlanta at the time. I was going to Georgia Tech and really loved the work. And at the end of the summer, they offered me a full-time job. And basically, I just jumped on it because the work was so fascinating. And then after 2 years, it was difficult to commercialize some of that work inside of the bowels of a very large organization. And we would sort of take it and demonstrate it to big organizations and they would want it. And then we just didn't have the muscle for commercialization. So I left to join a startup that was doing neural networks, applying it to fraud detection and supply chain problems and so on. And I just followed my interest in the technology, in things that I thought could start approximating human intelligence. Okay. And so big company, small company allowed me to see it commercialized. And, you know, sometimes you just get lucky. I joined a company that was doing great technology, but also had a great management team. And even though I worked in Atlanta at the time, the company was based in San Diego and we went public in 1995. Top 10 IPO. We were in Time magazine, the Time magazine that has Mark Andreessen on the cover. And, you know, when Netscape and Spyglass and these sort of early internet companies went public, we were in that batch and very, very fortunate to learn about that aspect of the journey. And so those, you know, AI and entrepreneurialism and startups became my interest professional.
Obviously, in this case, HNC Networks, you know, then, you know, Retech, you know, both IPOs, both opportunities where you were able to experience being one of the first employees to all of a sudden ringing the bell. What are some of the patterns, you know, that you can associate from one to another when it comes to ingredients that they cause success?
Yeah, this is good to know and good for folks to know in general. So in both of those companies, not only did we have really cool, capable technology, we had really interesting go-to-market motions and moats. Okay, with HNC at the time, the breakthrough was helping banks detect credit card fraud. And so we take that for granted now, but in the early 90s, you know, banks were starting to issue lots of credit cards and fraud was a really big problem. And developing a solution that sort of did that really well was very important. And that's its own story. But what was also really important is we created a consortium. Every time we signed a bank as a customer, they entered a consortium for fraud and they all contributed their fraud data to this consortium. And so we had access to more data. And we were able to stay ahead of the competition because our models saw more data and were able to be more accurate. And we, at some point, had 23 of the top 25 credit card issuing banks in the U.S. as customers, and it made that almost a monopoly for us. So combining the technology with a clever go-to-market was very important. With Retech, something very similar, it was, you know, picking Unix and Oracle, going into Y2K, and then partnering with Accenture. Again, it became a time when this became normal, but at the time it was fairly innovative to partner with a much larger, more scalable organization that can really support our go-to-market motion and give us both selling and delivery scale. And it allowed us to become the 800-pound gorilla of retail ERP and merchandising and supply chain software, even though we were a much smaller company and fed into an IPO in November of 99. And there was a point in time when this little software company was worth more than all the U.S. airlines combined, you know, because of the growth of the business that the business model provided for us. So business model, go-to-market combined with technology is the killer combination.
So, I mean, obviously at this point, you know, two IPOs under your belt, you probably feel like you're superhuman. So was that the moment where you're like, you know what, maybe I'm going to start something on my own right now?
Exactly. It sort of gets to your head. You start thinking it's you, it's all you, you know, and you're like, oh, this is easy. I should just do this on my own. And so in the early 2000s, I did, and helped start a company that was received some venture funding, but unfortunately it was a good idea too soon. And in our world, too soon is indistinguishable from wrong. And so immediately after two IPOs, I had a failure, or one that sort of a company that just became clear it was not on a good trajectory. Now, fortunately for me, within a year of doing that, someone I knew from my college days came to me and approached me about helping them get going with another intelligent applications company. So this company was called Optimi, or eventually we called it Optimi, and we were building applications in the cellular space, in the wireless network optimization space. And we had customers like Singular and AT&T Wireless and America Mobile and a bunch of others. And they were there trying to allocate billions of dollars to infrastructure and spectrum to move to GSM and ultimately to GPRS Edge UMTS standards while retaining the ability to run networks on the old technology. And so it's not easy to have a network where you have some people on like old standards and you're moving them to the new standard, but you have just a fixed amount of spectrum. So they needed a predictive technology, simulation technology. They needed prescriptive technology like wireless network optimization that made it possible to eke out, you know, every ounce of capacity from sort of these limited networks. And that one, because I was fortunate enough to have gone public twice, I was able to bootstrap with $300,000. And ultimately, without taking any more capital, that company sold to Ericsson for about $100 million. And so it's not a Silicon Valley outcome, but, you know, $300,000.
That's really incredible that you decided to bootstrap, because here you are, after having seen the experience of, you know, doing IPOs, seeing, you know, what venture funding, you know, can do. I mean, obviously money, when you're getting money from VCs, is also about the networks that they can bring to the table, and then also about the, let's say, the experience or the operational guidance that they could bring. Why didn't you take that on, and why did you just say, hey, you know what, I'm just going to do everything on my own. I don't need them.
I don't remember the details, but I suspect it was a combination of let's get going with this money and then very quickly learning that because so much was at stake for these wireless companies that they're willing to pay you to develop the stuff. And so why take investor money when you can just get revenue, customer money, right? The other part is, you know, at the time there were only six major wireless operators in the US. I think now there are like three or four. And I don't think the TAM was big enough to attract, you know, investors who want to invest in 30, 40 companies and have a couple of them become Google or Facebook or Airbnb or Uber, right? So Silicon Valley dynamics require, you know, people who are trying to deploy $1 billion or $2 billion of capital to make bets into companies that could become really, really large. And in this case, you know, we were able to create $100 million of value on $300,000 in, but recognizing that this is not a Sequoia type investment or, you know, Andreessen Horowitz type investment. And that's okay. You can still create a ton of value. We created a ton of value for a ton of people, starting with our customers and then eventually for ourselves as shareholders. So
what are you saying that moment like when you get the $100 million transfer into your bank account?
Well, the story is a little bit more complicated than that, but it feels really good that, you know, this little money in generated this kind of value. So The next company was a little bit easier. That was a $150 million exit. Also, not a lot of institutional money. Exited to a private equity-owned company called Infor that was looking to modernize, again, intelligent applications for the retail space. We went back into retail as an industry, building intelligent applications for merchandising, supply chain, revenue management. And there we were acquired by a company that was a roll-up of a whole bunch of older companies from the 90s that didn't make it. And they were looking for machine learning, cloud-based, modern, you know, differentiation. And we got 10x revenue back in 2016. So 10x, $15 million of revenue. So $150 million. And also without a lot of capital going in, into the actual company. So, and that was basically a check. And that was a very nice day when that happened. So
that's amazing. Now, one thing that is also important here, I mean, I love the saying, once you're lucky, twice you're good. And here, you know, we have obviously, you know, as we're walking through your story, many instances where you've been able to really, you know, make it happen. I guess, how do you also go about, you know, you keep going on launching businesses, but how do you also kind of like check yourself to make sure that you're not drinking your own Kool-Aid and making sure that you're able to have your foot on the ground with the companies that you decide to embark on?
Well, look, I think, you know, we're telling the story at a high level, but what we skip over in our memories sometimes, because we remember the happy endings, we don't remember the torture and the staring at the abyss and the nearly going out of business and not, you know, worrying about making payroll and all of those things that happen on the journey. And I think it's very important to remain grounded in all of that. And so having been very, very fortunate, I mean, worked very hard and worked with some amazing people, I also know that we had to get quite a few breaks on this journey. And really, I think it could have very easily turned out that all of these companies failed in a variety of ways. And so I think I'm grounded in that. I understand that, you know, it takes, you know, good luck, good fortune, good timing, and a lot of support from a lot of people who step in and help you when they don't have to. And so I have a lot of gratitude for my experience, but I really don't think it's, you know, it's luck free, let's say, you know.
Well, absolutely. And also, it's not a straight line. And I'm sure that you've been able to, you know, learn a lot from those ups and those downs. One thing that I wanted to double click there, you know, it's essentially, what has been, you know, your take from, let's say, founder dynamics or board dynamics where maybe things don't go well? And then also, how do you compare that to when things go well?
Oh, very interesting. So I've had two companies that I think would have done better if we had better founder dynamics and board dynamics. Okay, so in particular, those two companies I mentioned. Remember, Optima, I said it was a little bit of a complicated story. And it's interestingly, in my experience, success is more dangerous to founder dynamics and board dynamics than failure, okay? And what I mean by that is when you've actually built something and now you have something to lose, okay? Now there's something that's, you know, before it's an idea and let's give it a go, right? But now you think you created something worth $50 or $60 or $100 million, then now you have something to lose and people get scared when that happens. And also the other dynamic is there's sort of the dynamic around who gets credit and things like that. So lots of ways to kind of mess up founder dynamics. So in my most recent company, I was like, okay, we don't want to, you know, want to sort of prevent that kind of risk by, I didn't have a co-founder specifically. I have lots of colleagues who are very important technical founders and so on, but I just wanted sort of really clarity from a leadership perspective that we didn't have to deal with two or three equal parties that then, you know, when things get good, you're like, okay, where do we go from here? And then the disagreement around whether we keep doing what we've been doing or whether we change the strategy and so on. So unfortunately, I've lost, you know, a couple of friends on this journey because not, you know, everybody wants to be a startup person and not everybody's really wired for it, in my view. You know, it's sort of, it's grueling and requires comfort with risk and the operating in the fog of war, so to speak. And that's easier to do when you don't have anything. But once you've created something of value, it's like, oh, crap. You know, don't want to lose it. Okay. And especially if you think you can't do it again, this is like, for some people, it's like my one chance to do it. And it's almost, they're frozen with fear. So anyways, I did not know that, you know, I going into these things, I thought it would be more failure that would put stress on founder dynamics. But I found in my experience, anyways, it's actually success and then building something that you can be scared to lose can actually create a lot of issues.
Hey guys, so pardon the interruption here. So I got to tell you that, you know, for those of you that are either looking to raise money or you're looking to get your company acquired, you don't have to be alone. You know, there's a lot of psychology that needs to be blended with strategy, with methodology, with process. And it's very hard, and already doing your business alone is super, super difficult. So I remember, you know, back then when I was an entrepreneur, I kept really experiencing the challenge of either knowing or finding the right type of access to the right type of investors or really understanding what was the right type of guidance, you know, that would carry me through the process, whether it was with seeking money or with going through the acquisition. So that gap that I found being an entrepreneur is ultimately what pushed me later on when I met my co-founder at Pantera, Mike Severson, to really put together an advisory firm where we are guiding entrepreneurs and founding teams through the capital raising efforts, whether you are at a seed stage or at a Series A stage, or if you are going through the process of an acquisition and you are in small to mid-cap type of a cycle. So Again, you know, we would help you from guiding you and supporting you from A to C all the way to the end as an extension of your team. And there's no reason for you to do this alone. So with that being said, if you would like to find out more, feel free to send me an email at alejandro@panteraadvisors.com. And we would love to take a look at helping you out.
Now, once an entrepreneur, always an entrepreneur. So after you got that big fat check that you were alluding to, you know, essentially you went at it again. Now you went at it. I talk about, you know, timing too, because I find that being an entrepreneur is also about being at the right time in history. And that's, you know, obviously when you got started with relational AI, it was a little bit before this whole absolute craziness around AI as well. So why did you, you know, decide that relational AI was the next rodeo for you? And yeah, how did everything come together?
Yeah, well, first, I appreciate you saying that we're not like latecomers to this bandwagon. So in 2017, we picked the name relational AI. Now, we had deep learning and we had machine learning and all of that, but we very specifically picked relational AI because we believed in sort of the need for our AI for relational data, which is where most enterprises keep their data. So sort of the one way of thinking about the AI world is sort of consumer-oriented AI and then enterprise AI. And in the enterprise, the standards are higher, because you're making decisions that can, you know, hurt people and, you know, get, you know, hurt people like your customers, but also hurt the business, and you end up having to lay off people and so on. So you can't, it's often the case that these things have to operate with much more safety and rigor and attention to the law and things like that. And so the motivation for relational AI was I spent my career building companies that built intelligent applications for various industries and various problems, you know, retail, banking, telco were three that we mentioned, and things that involved combining lots of different techniques, predictive, prescriptive, graph analytics, rule-based reasoning, all sorts of techniques that usually, technically, you have different technology stacks that you have to pull together to support something like that, sometimes 5-6 different technology stacks. And in my observation, building an intelligent application was and remains really, really hard if you try to do it by stitching together 4 or 5 technologies, because you end up with a lot of glue and duct tape and chewing gum and paper clips. And a lot of your engineering energy goes into tying these things together as opposed to putting it in the actual content of the app that's going to help businesses run better. And given that in every applications company, we fought this, in every applications company, we ended up sort of, in a sense, rolling our own tooling and infrastructure to make that easier, I thought, well, the world needs something like this, so it's not limited to companies that, you know, one company at a time. And I understood that that's not a business you bootstrap, because now you're talking about infrastructure, and that's not something that you can get going easily. These types of systems need 3, 4, 5 years sometimes to put together. And so, you know, after we sold the last company, I moved to New York for a couple of years, like I mentioned, and then the deep learning wave came into being. And I thought, okay, let me try, you know, it would be a shame to end my career and not have Silicon Valley exposure. So moved the family to Silicon Valley. I live in Woodside, not far from Stanford, and started learning about how that community works. And really what I appreciate about the community is in Silicon Valley, the bigger the idea, the more interesting it is. In Atlanta, the bigger the idea, the more like, who do you think you are, you know, thinking this big. And then the whole town is just sort of about helping entrepreneurs with, you know, access to talent, access to funding, access to expertise, access to everything that you need. And very randomly ended up meeting a lot of people who were helpful, in particular, Bob Muglia, who had just left Snowflake after helping make it, you know, at the company that it is today. And we met sort of almost randomly through a social network. And he had been thinking at Snowflake about like how to bring AI to Snowflake. And when he understood that we were all about sort of AI for relational systems and putting AI in relational databases, he got very excited, very interested. And that really was a big, you know, breakthrough for us. So anyways, the idea was building intelligent applications is super hard. We want to make it easy. It requires new kinds of infrastructure. And that kind of infrastructure is not easy to build. So go west. young man or old man and see if you can get help on the journey. And very fortunately, it worked out. So the moving, to come back to the beginning, the sort of instinct for being comfortable with moving was really helpful here, because picked up the family and moved and enjoyed the journey of moving to somewhere new, and then, you know, benefited from that in terms of the network and the people who were there to help me.
So with relational AI, how do you guys make money? What's the business model there?
Yeah, it's very much like these data clouds, like Snowflake. So we go to market. So again, learning from our history, having a clever go-to-market strategy that has scale, that leverages someone else's investment in go-to-marketing, is very, very helpful for me in the past. And in this case, we aligned our, you know, our success with that of Snowflake and their customers. So we go to market as a co-processor. Snowflake calls it a native app that plugs into Snowflake that you can very easily turn on, and it's running inside Snowflake, inside the security perimeter, same governance, no need for copying data around and so on. And then imbuing Snowflake with all of the sort of AI technology that it doesn't come with. So obviously Snowflake comes with Gen AI technology and some document AI technology, but there's a lot of other AI technology that's really important. Sometimes people call that composite AI or compound AI or neurosymbolic AI or decision intelligence. Like business operates with a full suite of AI. Okay. It's not just a generative AI and a vector database. And so by plugging into that and aligning ourselves so that the Snowflake customer is delighted to have this option, because the alternative is I got to move all the data I have in Snowflake back out into these point solutions, means that Snowflake is delighted about delighting their customers. And then Snowflake obviously is establishing itself as a platform, not just as a data warehousing technology. So our adopting their platform is also really good for Snowflake. And we're obviously delighted because we tap into the $1.2 billion a year go-to-market machine that Snowflake has to go to market. And they have over 11,000 customers. And for every one of those customers, we're much better than the alternative.
That's amazing. And by the way, for the people that are listening now that would love to hear more about Snowflake, we actually had the current CEO of Snowflake also on the podcast. So he talks about the $100 billion business plan while at Google and all of that stuff. So great guy. So I guess one thing that comes to mind here, you know, while you're sharing this story as well, is here you raised $122 million. Why did you decide this time around to raise money versus bootstrapping?
Because this is infrastructure. This is not an app that you can just immediately tie to business value that you can deliver incrementally in pieces to, you know, people spending millions of dollars. So infrastructure just has a longer lead time. So this is like fundamental infrastructure that's combining AI with database technologies, with programming languages, with a variety of sort of fundamental things. And this requires real innovation, real, like the moats on what we do are very deep. It's not like a feature you can turn on or every database company or every Snowflake can implement. And so we're doing something, you know, deep and from first principles, and it's not something I felt we could bootstrap. I did the seed round. That was $7.5 million. So I did that. I could kind of get us going for a few years, but, you know, eventually we needed to, you know, raise proper money. So
when you went at it, you know, for the first time with outside investors for your Series A, I mean, the next round, why did you decide to choose the investors, whether it's Series A or beyond, why those investors versus others? Because, I mean, at this point, you've had the opportunity of having great success. You've made investors a lot of money in the past too. And people can see you as one of those tier zero founders that are very difficult to come across. Those ones that really understand what needs to be done, and that they're taking money not for the education, but for the execution, which really sets you apart, you know, as a special breed. So why did you choose the investors that you did choose for this journey?
Yeah, I appreciate you asking me that as well, because the Series A in particular was very heavily oversubscribed. So when I first moved to Silicon Valley, I didn't really understand the model. And so I had a few, maybe three or four conversations with folks that made me realize I'm not speaking the language of this town. Okay. And in particular, our idea was so big and required, because you're operating from first principles, I didn't know how to even explain it to folks before Gen AI and before some of these things that have happened since then. It took someone like Bob, who is a product person, who is deep into, you know, has seen sort of story relational databases, to understand what we were saying. And so when he got involved, that made things very much easier for us because, you know, he had just, you know, helped create a company that did really, really well. And like I said, largest software IPO of all time when it went public. And so his involvement meant there was a long line of people who were interested. And so anyways, it was a $40 million round. But interestingly, of the $40 million, 22 was insiders. Bob, myself, other board members, my colleagues who had done well in previous companies together, we all wrote checks. And I had to say no to quite a few VCs. And the reason that we went with the VCs that we went with is because Bob and I had both seen the negative impact of having the wrong kind of VC, the wrong partner, okay? And we really optimized for the kind of people that we thought had the values that we wanted to work with. And in particular, Soma from Madrona stood out as someone who is, you know, will do the right thing, let's say. And so we were delighted to have Madrona and Soma lead the round. We created room for, just said, like, really, we were oversubscribed. Actually, it was a little bit of a problem for me. I had to say no to some people that were friends, and they took it the wrong way because they were not willing to lead, but also not willing to, you know, to kind of write a small check. Anyways, and so we were also fortunate to have Lee Fixel and Addition participate, and then Menlo also participate in a small way. And yeah, it was mostly, like I said, it was more half the money was Bob and myself and others really supporting the round. And then the Series A, as the Series B happened very quickly thereafter, like within 6 months, unsolicited. Tiger Global, I think, you know, had the vision to understand what we were doing and to see that, you know, Soma and Bob were involved. And that happened, you know, in a Tiger Global sort of way at the time, which is, you know, call, term sheet, you know, close within 30 days kind of thing, which was also an interesting and fun story for a fun experience, really, for me, having lived in outside of Silicon Valley and never experienced something like that as well.
So obviously, you know, those investors are betting on a vision, no? The future that you're living into with relational AI. So I guess with relational AI, if you were to go to sleep tonight, Malham, and you wake up in a world where the vision is fully realized, what does that world look like?
Yeah, I mean, I think that world means that building intelligence into these systems that we use to make decisions becomes cheaper and cheaper. And we've basically made it possible for people to do that. And so the quality of decision making for any organization, not just pure businesses, okay, becomes better. And so right now, it's just too hard to amplify or to, you know, curate or to help decision makers across the board, right? You see it at the level of governments, questionable decision making, because there's no ability to really predict the consequence of that decision, if you know what I mean. And if you can now make every decision with the benefit of a good prediction about what will happen if you make that decision on what timeline, okay, then decision making improves. And I think it's a better world because of that, right? You don't have, you know, people, uninformed people or people who could have made a better decision making, you know, uninformed bad decisions that lead to the failure of companies and governments and societies and all of that. So
we're talking about the future. I want to talk about the past, if you let me, and do so with a lens of reflection. If I was to put you into a time machine and I bring you back in time, at that moment where you're about to turn page with Retech, and that moment where you're now feeling superhuman, about to start your own company. And let's say you have the opportunity of sitting down, you know, right in front of that younger Malham, and you're able to give yourself one piece of advice for launching a business. What would that be and why, given what you know now?
Yeah, I mean, pick your partners well. Understand the sacrifices that are involved. You know, one thing that I learned is just the power of just getting out every day, putting one foot in front of the next, and not giving up. And you know, those types of things, it's kind of trite at some level, you know, but it's just hard to understand until you've lived it, right? When there were a few moments where I'm just like, I have no idea how we're going to make payroll, and just getting up and trying, doing it led to the right outcome. And so it's really, really, really hard. It's not for everybody. And there are you pay a price, you pay a cost. There are, you know, people in my life that I wish I had spent more time with. You know, they're just, you know, even when I'm physically there with my friends and family, sometimes I'm not really there, if you know what I mean, you know? And so there's a big price to pay. But, you know, for me, I'm just, this is my passion. This is what I enjoy, the combination of the technology and the startup, the entrepreneurial journey. And so, yeah, no regrets, even though it's a big price to pay.
I hear you. Well, Molham, it has been an absolute honor. Thank you so, so much for being on the Dealmaker Show. I guess for the people that are listening that would love to reach out and say hi, what is the best way for them to do so?
Yeah, you know, first name, last name, and relationally on LinkedIn. And I have a Twitter. You can, again, look for my name. You can sort of DM me there. And so LinkedIn, email, and Twitter. So, or X. Yeah.
There you go. Well, hey, Molham, thank you so much for being on the Dealmaker Show today. Such an honor to have you with us.
Thank you, Alejandro. I really, really appreciate it.
If you like the show, make sure that you hit that subscribe button. If you could leave a review as well, that would be fantastic. And if you got any value, either from this episode or from the show itself, share it with a friend. Perhaps they also appreciate it. So also remember that if you need any help, whether it is with your fundraising efforts or with selling your business, you can reach me at alejandro@pantheraadvisors.com.
You've reached the end of another episode of the Dealmakers Podcast. For free resources and materials, head over to alejandrocremades.com. Thank you for listening, and see you at the next episode.